Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now for the math news. Just kidding. Math has had a good run, though. Its virtues were extolled during the presidential debates. Endless news stories calculated fiscal scenarios. New York Times blogger Nate Silver was pilloried and then vindicated. Still, mathematics and the data-driven statistics that guide decisions, from Wall Street to the dugout to your insurance rates, can be intimidating and woefully misunderstood. Statistics cannot be any smarter than the people who use them, writes Dartmouth senior lecturer Charles Whelan in his new book, Naked Statistics: Stripping the Dread from the Data. Whelan uses vivid examples and blessedly little math to teach us about the promises and pitfalls of data and probability. And he's here from Dartmouth to tell us more. Charles, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Oh, it's good to be back with you.
So it is tough to make statistics exciting. I liked your idea that a statistician is like someone doing forensic medicines, you know, gathering information at the scene of a crime. Can you play that out for us?
Sure. Sometimes it's literally true. If you look at DNA analysis, which we all now take for granted, most of that is actually rooted in probability. We don't know for certain. When you get a DNA sample, it doesn't have somebody's name on it. Instead, it's got a certain set of genetic material and the probability that it matches both the suspect and some other stranger in the population is going to determine whether we actually think it's a match or not a match. So in some cases, the statistics are literally the clues in the case of a crime. But in a lot of other cases, such as public health, where we're trying to connect things like your diet and colon cancer or exercise and obesity and heart disease, we're looking at clues that present themselves in data. And statistics is the set of tools that we use to analyze those clues.
But you can't exactly make a watertight case, even if you had the right DNA. This is one of the things that you point out in the book. There are a number of different fallacies that a lot of people play by in the real world. The prosecutor's fallacy, for example. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. One of the things, if I came to you and said, look, here's a DNA match between the blood that was found on the knife at the scene of the crime and it matches with somebody else who's committed murder, and the probability that it matches that person and another complete stranger is one in a million, would you be comfortable convicting this person? And I think most of us would say, sure. I mean, it's a convicted felon. We may not actually be able to know that in court, so this person's already violent. It's a one in a million match, so let's go ahead and convict. Well, what if I then said, okay, well, the reason we found the match is because we ran the DNA sample through an existing DNA database, which consists of 1 million felons, in which case it shouldn't be surprising that we get a one in a million match just by chance, or second, that it matches with somebody who's already committed a violent crime, because those are the only people in the database, in which case this person may not even live in the same state as the crime, may not have anything to do with it. So you have to be very cognizant of the context in which even something like a one in a million match happens to crop up.
So that's part of the rub here, that there are so many, say there are a million names on this DNA database, because of the availability of more information, that doesn't necessarily create more accuracy.
No. One of the things I go to great lengths to point out in the book is the distinction between accuracy and precision. Precision is the exactitude with which I tell you something. So if you're lost and I say, look, the next gas station is 1.265 miles down the road, that is precision. If I do that while pointing you in the wrong direction, that is inaccuracy. And so my precise answer actually probably gives you a false sense of comfort that I must actually know what I'm talking about. In fact, I've just pointed you in the wrong direction. That can be quite dangerous, as we learned in the Wall Street collapse of 2008.
Open that up for me, because you do point out that there was, let's say, a confusion among many banks and their statisticians, who you call what, quants?
What's the quants, yeah. Everyone else calls them nerds, but I think their name on Wall Street is the quants. And these are people who paid a lot of money to build very sophisticated models, in particular to build sophisticated models of risk. At the time, there was a very common model called value at risk. And what it purported to do was to use probability to collapse all the different trades and positions within a firm into a single number that was called the value at risk. And in theory, 99 times out of 100, this is the maximum that the firm could lose over whatever period the value at risk had been calculated. So if our value of at risk for the next 24 hours is $100 million, then 99 times out of 100, the maximum exposure we have is $100 million. These reports were actually called the 415 reports because they were dropped on executives' desks every day at 4:15 after the American markets closed. And if I give you a number that says our value at risk is $97.2 million, that gives the sense that I actually know what I'm talking about. The problem is that the risk models were terrible. They, for example, included assumptions like the idea that real estate prices would never drop. That was because it was calculated based on data over a period when real estate didn't go down. The danger here, this risk of conflating accuracy and precision, is that if you think you have a speedometer and it's really broken, you're going to ignore the other clues that you might be going too fast. If you actually have no speedometer at all, then you have no choice but to kind of look around and use common sense judgment. But once those value at risk models gave the Wall Street folks an artificial sense of their risk, they started to do things they shouldn't have been doing.
This gets to this idea of human perception, but also, you know, that there is a belief that risk can be outrun on some level. What is wrong with that?
Well, there's always a certain randomness to any risk. And there is, of course, the probability, and improbable events happen all the time. Say there's a 1 in a million chance that this particular malfunction in an airline engine will cause a crash. Well, if you've got a million flights in the day, that's not an acceptable level of risk. And there's also a certain randomness to it. So very rare events still happen. My favorite example being a fellow who was struck by lightning on his way to buy a lottery ticket. Mm. My point is he got an improbable outcome. It just wasn't the one he was looking for.
I think a lot of people, especially in the financial crisis, and you're looking at this broken VAR model, but a lot of people want to ascribe blame for the financial crisis. And you look at this more as what? Hubris and belief in a risk model that didn't work rather than malevolence. But when using data to your own advantage, when does it become malevolent?
Well, I would say even in the case of the Wall Street, malevolence enters a little bit in that it allows you to justify behaviors that in the absence of the models you might not be able to justify, whether that's risk-taking, which isn't inherently malevolent, but some of the things that were going on within firms, you could still point to the models and say, hey, we're not really at great risk here. And of course, if you don't think you're at great risk within the firm, then you can also deny that you're creating systemic instability. So I think that those false safeguards certainly invited bad behavior, whether it was malevolent or not, I don't know. And in the case of other statistics, I'm not sure you have to have malevolent intent as much as a point of view, that statistics don't lie, but they can tell a lot of different stories depending on the statistics you choose to use. I think at one point I described statistical arguments like bad marriages, that people are talking past one another. They're not really even confronting the same issues.
We're talking with Charles Whelan. He's at Dartmouth, and he is the author of Naked Economics. That's a best-selling book. His new book is called Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. Well, part of the dread, I guess, is that people may be hearing things that they don't necessarily want to hear. I'm thinking of the cases of where statistics is played against the gut, the instinct. This is a battle we saw in baseball, profiled in the film Moneyball, for example, and also with the New York Times blogger Nate Silver's prediction models during the 2012 election. Why do mathematics so often get pitted against instinct? Is there a real clear distinction here?
I think there is. Evolutionary biologists and other folks in the sciences are starting to understand better how we make decisions. And in a lot of cases, there are shortcuts that happen in our brain, particularly when it comes to things like risk. You know, if you see something slithering in the grass, you can either kind of slowly investigate or you can get a signal sent to your spinal cord that says, hey, this is probably a poisonous snake, jump. In many cases, those impulses are very, very important. In other cases, the shortcuts tend to lead us to make erroneous judgments. And risk is one of those places where we are notoriously bad in terms of understanding the true risks involved. I'll give you an example. After September 11th, a lot of people stopped flying. Certainly in the first few months after the attacks, people decided they were going to drive instead. Well, what we know is even in the face of those terrorist attacks and the now increasingly rare plane crash, it is still much, much more dangerous to ride in a car. In fact, I once had a discussion with a guy here in New Hampshire who was making this argument. He was telling me that he was afraid to fly as he stood next to his motorcycle. And I then, at that point, called my research assistant straight away and said, you got to calculate the risks of riding a motorcycle relative to flying. It was something like 1,000 times as dangerous. So that would be an example where we don't get the risk right. And after September 11th, there's actually a sad postscript, which there were some academics who looked at traffic accidents in the 3 months after September 11th. And what they found was that because people increasingly turned to the roads and driving is more dangerous than flying, there was actually a spike in auto fatalities. And during the time frame they looked, it appeared that the number of additional traffic fatalities was at least as high as the number of people who died in the original September 11th attacks.
So if people had paid attention to the real statistics, they might have chosen to fly. There might have been fewer road accidents. But this is a question. When should we be wary of statistics? For example, it creates a lot of problems in our society that there is, for example, racial profiling.
This is a great point. I think there are some creeping moral and judgment issues that we don't normally associate with math. Math is math. One of the things that we can now do is because we've got so much data, we can use the data to make predictions about things that are likely to happen in the future. I'll give you one that's both a little scary but also telling, and that is the retailer Target. It's a story that's related in the book. Target realized that women who are pregnant, particularly women in their second trimester, make retail decisions that are likely to last for a very long time. So that if you can lure pregnant women into your store and get them to become regular shoppers, they're likely to be kind of lifelong customers. The key, of course, is to find women when they're pregnant, and this is not always that easy to do. So Target actually hired statisticians, and they had a little bit of help in that pregnant women can register for baby showers, and they can register at Target. Now what we can do is because we're scanning the items that they buy and collecting other information, we can learn an awful lot about the shopping habits of women we know are pregnant. Then we can look across our other customers, for whom we're also collecting a lot of data, and we can make an educated guess as to who is also pregnant. They start to buy more cotton balls. They switch to unscented lotions. There are about 25 different things that pregnant women do that tip off the predictive model. So what Target did is they started sending coupons to people they suspected were pregnant. Well, what happened was there was a father in Minnesota who had a high school daughter, and he called up the local Target store, and he said, stop it. Why are you sending coupons to my daughter for cribs and diapers? She hasn't graduated from high school. Why are you planting this idea in her mind? And the store manager apologized profusely, and he even called back later to apologize again. And at that point, the father in Minneapolis said, well, actually, there have been some things going on here we didn't know about.
Oh.
Turns out his daughter was pregnant. And Target was able to figure it out before he was.
Oh.
So this gives you some sense of what the predictive value is of these data. Now, back to where you mentioned with racial profiling, we've actually gotten to the point, which I think is good, where we can identify hot spots in cities. So we can watch gang activity, we can watch patterns of violent crimes, and we can make educated guesses about where are dangerous corners likely to pop up. That's all good if you're channeling resources. But if you take it one step further and you start to collect data on the kinds of people who are likely to be conducting crimes, then at that point it enters into very morally ambiguous territory. If we know that somebody of a certain ethnic or racial profile who happens to show up at a certain time, who happens to be driving a certain car, is more likely to be engaged in nefarious activity, then if you happen to fit that profile, but you're one of the vast majority of people not engaged in criminal activity, then your life is going to be a living hell. So we do have to make decisions about how we want to use this data, and more importantly, how we want to let others, including law enforcement, use it as well.
Charles Whelan, Senior Lecturer at Dartmouth, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
That was great fun. Thank you for having me.
In addition to being a lecturer at Dartmouth, he's author of the book Naked Economics and the new book called Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. We have much more information on the book, including links to some reviews, at our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio.